Thank you. My name is Jenny Peacock, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I'm here because I don't want to drink again. And I would like to thank the committee for asking me to participate as a young people speaker. What were they thinking? I'm going to be 60 next year, so I was completely baffled when I got asked to participate, but I said yes. So, I mean, aren't these kids cute up here? I mean, I'm old enough to be their grandmother. And then somebody from the committee said yes, but, you know, you got sober at a really young age. I said, well, I got sober when I was 32 years old, you know, almost 27 years ago. But today that's not even young, and I'm sitting next to Kevin, and you know, he's 32 now, and he got sober when he was 16, so. I'm sure he'll be up here speaking, you know, any year now. I'm really sorry they're not filming this. I mean, I said to Kevin, I bleached my teeth for nothing. I was I know the traditions. My job today to try to carry the message to one person in the room. So if I've helped one person today, then I've done my job. And, you know, if you're new or used and you're here today, you know, it's prime sun time to hear me. You must be really sick. That's all I could think of. I said to Barbara, we're sitting at the pool, and I said, I have to go speak. Who on earth would leave the pool to go to a meeting? And I said, just the sick ones. And here we are. My sponsor always speaks at a 2 o'clock meeting in the desert, so, and plenty of people go to that. So, you know, I'm just very, very grateful to be alive and sober today. And what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like now, it all began in Indiana. I grew up in an alcoholic family. My father was a town drunk. He bootlegged gin during the Prohibition. I grew up in a town of 6,000 white people in a town called Kendall, Indiana. It is still 6,000 white people. The water tower says the world takes what Kendall makes, and they took me, so. You know, my story is sort of like the movie The Hoosiers, where, you know, the whole town goes to the basketball game on Friday night, and my brother was a basketball star, I was a cheerleader. My dad was like Dennis Hopper in the movie. He came to the game drunk. I grew up in saloons with my dad growing up. He drank Drury's and he bought it by the case. He wore one of those hats, not one of those baseball hats, but one of those sort of fedora-looking hats. And he smoked non-filtered Camel cigarettes. And, you know, his fingers were orange, you know, and everyone in my family drank. He just drank when he came to our house. You know, if he came over to see Ick and Helen, my parents would say, you know, want a drink. Even if it was the milkman, just anyone, do you want a drink? And alcohol was around. I think, you know, when I was very young, Sandy, Eddie, a friend of mine down the street, we turned the lights off when my dad was passing out on the sun porch and drank out of the Drury bottle. You know, I don't much remember drinking until high school. And I remember in high school, I started to drink. I felt very odd in my family. I felt like I was always sort of conceived in Krypton, and dropped in this very odd family in Indiana to grow up. And I spent a lot of time getting away from the house. And I was very popular in school. I won the 8th grade American Legion Citizenship Award. And it was downhill from there. I became a cheerleader. I was a cheerleader for 6 years, you know, I just, you know, fire. Loved it. I could be up in front of the school, you know, and I was very skinny. I was very flat-chested. You know, the guys, you know, called me SAG as a joke. And what happened to me was sometime, like, around my senior year in high school, I had a 49 Plymouth. I took to get an orange-flavored vodka and smoking Salem cigarettes. And one night, a bunch of my girlfriends and a couple guys on the football team, we went out and we decided we would spray paint a bridge viaduct, KHS class of 60. and I drew the short straw, and so I was suspended over the side of the viaduct, you know, by my ankles, and I spray painted it upside down, you know, KHS class of 60. And we thought it was really fabulous. And what happened was all the other classes started to spray paint, and they spray painted barns, you know, over two mail pouches. Now they just spray painted, and so it was sort of set off this wave of graffiti over northern Indiana. And so the guys on the football team were bragging about it in the locker room one day, and the coach overheard them, and they got called in to the superintendent, and they were, you know, you have to tell us. So they gave all of our names, and our parents were called in on an afternoon, and we had to forfeit our driver's licenses. We could not drive. I had to surrender my pom-poms. I could no longer be a cheerleader, you know, in front of the school body. I was a disgrace. And they told me that I couldn't be Lady Macbeth in the spring play, and that one really irritated me. And so I just took to smoking cigarettes and drinking orange-flavored vodka to the end of the school year. And I said to my mother, you know, they're never going to take me alive, and I'm going to leave this hick town, and I ain't ever coming back. And I went away to Bloomington, Indiana, to Indiana University in 1960. And I was there for the next 14 years until I got sober in 1974. And alcohol didn't impair my studying one bit. Before I left town to go off to college, my family doctor said, Virginia, I'm going to give you a little something that will help you study. It's a little diet pill. And this will help you stay awake at night. And it did. And I got to college, and I joined a sorority. I'm a Delta, Delta, Delta. I'm a Tri-Delta. I had a sorority sister who worked in a pharmacy in Downersville, Illinois, and she said, you know, I know how to write scripts. And I said, So she said, if you go to the local doctor and steal prescription pad, I can write them, we can take them, and we can sell them. So, you know, away I went to the local doctor. They put you in that little room for 20 minutes to a half an hour. I stole prescription pads. I stole the physician's desk reference. And I went back to Karen, and Karen started writing them, you know, for Dextrodrine and Benzedrine. And we were taking them, and we were selling them on the second floor of the Tri-Delta house. And we were very, very popular, Karen and me. And, you know, I had a cooler in my room. I drank Cutty Sparks because that was the thing to drink then, and we drank Beefeaters. I drank anything. You know, we just always had a cooler in the room, and we played bridge, and, you know, we would go to dinner, and we wouldn't be hungry, and, you know, Mother Hannah would ask what was wrong, you know, and we would not say anything. We were just sucking our mouths, and we would go back up to our room, and we'd smoke cigarettes, and we'd play bridge, and we'd drink, and, you know, until 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning, and we'd just take a, you know, we'd go down to the kitchen, break in the kitchen, fry some eggs, go up, take a mouthful of pills, fall asleep for a couple hours, and then, you know, boing, you know, wake up and go off to class, suck in our mouths for the whole day, and then come home at 4, you know, and start drinking to take the edge off. And, you know, it's just a part of my story. I'm a speed freak and an alcoholic. I only identify as an alcoholic because it's redundant to say I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I'm an alcoholic, and alcohol is a drug, and it sort of covers everything. I mean, I love to drink. I mean, I absolutely love to drink, and if alcohol still worked for me, I'd still be drinking. And I mean, I played, and I partied, and I was popular, and guys liked to take me out. I was a great date. I never threw up. I never passed out. You know, and I had lots of pills, and I was very, very popular. And Karen and I dated these two guys who were FIGAMs, and they had guns. And this was like 1962, 63, long before, you know, kids were shooting kids. And we would go out into a cornfield and shoot bottles, you know, and Karen took the gun once back into the house, and she got drunk one night, and she was, you know, walking up and down the house with this gun because they weren't going to let her be president of the house, and everybody got all upset, and I don't know why. And they came to me, and they said, Virginia, your Karen's roommate, give us the gun. I said, no, I'm not going to do that, because you'll lift her pin, and you'll throw her out of the house. They said, no, Virginia, we promise you we won't. So I gave them the gun, and they lifted her pin, and they threw her out of the house, and that really irritated me, too. So I took nine of my sorority sisters. I quit the Tri-Delta house. I moved off campus. I moved into an apartment house. I changed my major from, you know, speech and hearing therapy to Slavic languages and literature. And I got a job in a local bar on Kirkwood Avenue called Nick's English Hut. I got a green book bag. I got, you know, all the books, you know, Allen Ginsberg, Ken Kesey, Kerouac, you know, Naked Lunch. I'm like, whoa. I hung out in this bar because I worked there, and in this bar in the front table, there was a table up front, sort of like the Algonquin Hotel in New York, and all these guys would come in every day who were philosophy majors, and they all rode BMW bikes, and I mean, they were big and burly and bearded, and, you know, they sat up front, and they were reading Aldous Huxley, and they were talking about, you know, taking lysergic acid diethylamide, you know, LSD, and, you know, I thought they were really, really, really cool. So I wanted to be like them, so, you know, I got a motorcycle. I didn't grow a beard, but I did. I got the motorcycle, and, you know, I was riding my bike one night, and I met another woman on a motorcycle, and she sort of cut me off and came back and said to me, you know, I thought I was the only woman in this town that rode a bike. And I said, well, obviously you're not. And she said, well, my name's Barbara. And, you know, I fell madly in love with her. It was like she was a heroin addict and an alcoholic, and she rode a bigger bike than mine. And it was 1964, and this was, you know, long before lesbians were on the cover of Newsweek, and long before Ellen had a show, lost a show, you know, there was no Katie Lang, there was no Will and Grace, there was nothing. There was still, you know, the love that dare not speak its name. So we decided we would, you know, shoot up and go over to Paris and live like Gertrude and Alice. And so we took off for Europe, and I told my parents I was going to go study at the Sorbonne University. Of course, I had no intention of studying. Barbara taught me how to shoot dope, and, you know, we're drinking, and we're rolling some guy on the Audubon, and, you know, we got to Paris, and she said, you know, I don't think I want to be a lesbian. Oh, I was like, no, I was really irritated again, and so so we hitchhiked back to London, to Heathrow Airport. We had this huge fight, and she punched me out and flew home. And so I called Maynard, my motorcycle mechanic, because my grandparents had given me a lot of money for graduating from college in 1964 with a BA, you know, in Slavic languages and literatures. And so they think I'm studying, you know, in Paris, so they gave me all this money, and I sent for Maynard, my motorcycle mechanic. And I flew him over, met him in London. It was 1964, the mods and the rockers, you know. The mods, you know, wore those cute little mini skirts and boots and all that stuff. And Maynard and I wore those full black, you know, barber jackets and leather pants. And I went up to Birmingham, and I bought him a 500cc Velocet single bike. I mean, a black bike with a black touring fairing, and we hung out with the rockers for several months, you know, running around, going up to the Busy Bee Cafe, all this stuff, you know, Liverpool, Johnny Hooker, and it was great fun, and I was, you know, selling Purple Hearts on Trafalgar Square, and we're drinking, and it was fun, and we decided that we would go down to Spain, and we went down to Spain, and I gotta tell you, you know, this bike, it's a bike from, you know, 1964, when back then you had to start a bike by kicking it. And you kicked this pedal down, and then you had to quick get your leg, you know, out of the way, or else it would, like, break your calf in half. And I just was saying that for all of you people that turn your little key out there in the parking lot on the bike. I mean, we were really butch then, and we went down to Spain. I took in all these gypsies. I rented a five-bedroom house. I took in all these people, and then there was a dock strike. We had to fly the bike back to Houston. We flew home, and Maynard left me. But in that year that I was gone, Barbara, the woman that I had been madly in love with, married a guy in Bloomington, Indiana named Junior Peacock. And, well, honey, don't laugh. When I got home, she divorced him, so I married him. So So Barbara moved to San Francisco into the Haight-Ashbury, and Junior and I moved down to West Baden, Indiana, about, 10 miles from French Lick. And Barbara lived in the Haight and started sending us bags of meth crystal in books, the guy that failed books that, they didn't have dogs then sniffing it out either. And she and I moved down to West Baden, Indiana to live, off the land and get healthy. And we're feed freaks now. And, there had been this laundromat in Bloomington, Indiana. I thought of this today when I was talking to this guy, Rooster. There was a laundromat in Bloomington called Feed Queen. And I loved the laundromat. And I went every time, and they had little glasses that had stripes that said Feed Queen on them, and every time I went to the laundromat, I stole a glass. They put them out to measure your soap, and so, our house, the only dishes we had were, Feed Queen glasses, and, but some of the things I don't miss, on those tables where you fold your clothes, if you came in and I was particularly having a bad day, it was right across from the liquor store, but you could find me over on the folding table, and Junior hung drywall. Let me tell you, he hung it really quickly. And I would turn the pockets of his pants inside out before I ever put his pants in the washing machine, because he would find me over, the folding table just sucking the inside of his pants to get pieces of deck from there and whatever it was, just always taking to find whatever I could. And then I would go across the street and get myself a bottle of Gordon's vodka with the orange screw cap. And it's just how we lived. And we decided we would get really healthy and we'd go down and live off the land in southern Indiana. So we went down and we bought 19 acres. And Max and Linda bought land over there, and Dick and Diane bought land over here. And we bought a house that didn't have any, kitchen or bathroom to it, but it had water, so we had a garden hose. So, I would just take the dishes and throw them out into the yard and turn the hose on them. I didn't have a shower. So I got a job teaching school in Salem, Indiana, junior high school English, in 1968. And from 1968 to 1974, until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I never did a sober breath unless I was locked up in a mental institution, incarcerated in a jail, or locked down, strapped down somewhere. And, it just wasn't pretty at all. I had to drink. And I had to drink, I had to drink, I had to drink. I could not stop drinking. I drank on a daily basis. I was a blackout drinker. I drank around the clock. I drank vodka because I knew you couldn't smell it. I drank 1 to 2 quarts of vodka a day. I drank a half pint of vodka, driving my car over to Salem, Indiana in the morning. And I had one of those great alcoholic cars with no floorboard. One headlight goes this way and one goes over here. And it had a stick shift. You had to participate in your driving. I just hated that shit. And I would have the car windows down because I couldn't stay awake. And I passed out the night before. And I was teaching school in the same skirt all the time. And, we had 12 hens and a rooster, Donald. I would sell, 3 dozen eggs for $1. And sometimes I'd forget to change my shoes. I'd go to school and I still had the shoes with the chicken shit on them and the skirt that I'd wore for, the whole year. And every now and then I would change the top if I thought of it. And I would stand outside the classroom, and Mr. Hunt, the principal, would come over and he would stand next to me and he'd say, "Well, good morning, Mrs. Peacock. How are you today?" And I'd say, "I'm just fine, Mr. Hunt." And I would have maybe 2 black eyes or my mouth was all full and some junior beat me. I married a man who just beat me and beat me and beat me. And, I don't know why. I would tell him I was going out for groceries on Friday and I would come back on Tuesday. And he was mad, and he was a violent drunk, and he would beat on me, and if he kicked me, I would kick him back, and I kicked him back once, and I couldn't walk for 2 or 3 days. So, we would just shoot drugs, and we would drink, and around the clock, once he was beating on me, and he broke my eardrum in the left side of my head, and I didn't want to hit him back, so I just picked up lamps and books and whatever was in the house, and I just broke out all the windows in the house. I mean, just hit all the glass, you know, that tinkling of glass. And we had these 12 hens and that rooster Donald, and, you know, there's no glass on the window, so they just came into the house with us. And we had mulberry trees, so the chickens ate the mulberries. They came in the house. They just shit purple all over the house. And, you know, all we're doing is, like, hiding our booze and hiding our dopes, and he's going off to hang drywall, and I'm going off to teach junior high school English. And I finally thought, you know, I can't do this anymore. This man is beating me to a pulp. And so I left him, and I went home to Kendallville, Indiana, where my father was dying of alcoholism, and my father was very sexually abusive with me, and I knocked him out of a chair, and the next thing I know, I was being handcuffed, and the sheriff was taking me away, and my mother was saying, "It's for your own good, honey." She just committed me to a mental institution. So away I went to Oaklawn Psychiatric Center. She billed me for it, too, and $10,000. And away I went, you know, to this treatment place. It wasn't really treatment. It was a loony bin, and it had barbed wire, and there was the Vietnam War, and people were doing shock treatments, and, you know, they wanted to talk to me, and I had tracks up and down my arms, and I was a lesbian, and I drank one or two quarts of booze a day, and, you know, they were like, ooh. And, you know, they finally released me. I tore up bingo night and the roller skating party too much, and they said, they told me I didn't respond to treatment, and so after about 8 or 9 months, I got out, and I went back to Bloomington, Indiana, because it was the only place I knew, and if we were going to be gay in the state of Indiana, it was the only place to be as well. And so I went back to Bloomington, and I moved in with 8 or 9 drag queens, and I got a job teaching in a parochial school for Sister Rose Claire, and she hated me. Absolutely hated me. My students liked me, but she didn't. And the teachers would come to pick me up at about 7 o'clock in the morning to, in a teacher pool, and I would get into the car with a half pint of vodka and an open can of beer. And no one ever, ever dared to turn around and say, "Virginia, do you think you should be drinking at this hour? Or, you know, maybe you have a problem." I mean, you know, I learned to do more than just hang up these queen's dresses. I mean, I had a mouth on me that wouldn't quit, and if you said anything to me, you know, you would be in tears before we got to the corner. So people just left me alone. And I carried a big bag, just like I still do. And I always, it was big enough to put a bottle of vodka in it. And I drank at school. I drank, you know, I would go to the bathroom and I would drink. And, you know, I finished that job. I got a stint in a RCA factory in Bloomington, Indiana, when I was living with Lady Jane. And, you know, it was on an assembly line, and this, you know, a frame is coming by, and you've got a hot iron, and you have to thread this solder, and you have to hit 13 spots on this set while it's going by, and then the next one's coming. And I was so strung out and so hungover, I would miss them, and I would get off my stool, and all the women would yell, "Dinah's down, Dinah's down," and they'd all get off and try to help me, and the foreman would come and say, "You know, you're really not any good at this," and go to the dispensary, and I would just go in the bathroom, and I'd slam that stall, and I would just drink that vodka, and I thought, "Oh, my God, I can't even do this job." And then I was a Democrat, and which was very contrary to my mother, who was, you know, chairman of the Republican Party in Noble County, and I had, of course, become a Democrat just to spite her because I hated her. And so the mayor's office decided way back when they were going to put women in non-traditional jobs. And so one of the non-traditional jobs was driving a bus for the city of Bloomington. So I asked to do that. So they gave me a job as a muni driver, which is really like my last job of gainful employment. And I drove the bus drunk. I drank on the bus. I drank. And you have to remember, I'm drinking a quart, two quarts of vodka a day. And My friend Melanie worked at the switchboard for the city, and she would call me at about 5 o'clock in the morning to get up, and I would get up, you know, whatever I passed out in the night before was what I wore to work. I always wore the same clothes. I never took them off. I never laundered them. They called me the big wrinkle at work, and the only thing I would do would be that I would have enough presence of mind to grab a different shirt. And so when I got out there, and then my bus, you know, had a 45-minute run to the mall, and when I got to the mall, there was a Superex drugstore, so I would go into the public restroom. I would take the Bloomington Transit shirt off, put the other shirt on, and go into the Superex drugstore, and they'd say, well, good morning, Virginia, you're not working today, if you notice my day off. And I'd buy a quart of Gordon's vodka, and I would stop in the mall at the Orange Julius and ask for the tallest cup of ice they had, get a lid and straw. I'd go back into the bathroom, fill that cup up with ice, and I mean, fill it up with vodka, put the lid on it, take that shirt off with the Bloomington Transit shirt back on, and go and get on my bus. And it was enough to quiet the shakes that I had. I mean, I shook all the time if I didn't have a drink. I had to drink. And, you know, I had a tape player with me, and I had 2 tapes for the entire year, the Brandon Burke Concertos and Olivia Newton-John. And come, you know, these kids probably don't even know who that is, so come 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, I'm driving my bus, you know, a lot faster than I was at 6. And, you know, people get on my bus I didn't like, I just brake real hard and throw them all over. I became filled with self-hate and self-loathing, and so I didn't like anybody, and, you know, and my hair hurt, you know, sometimes, I needed a drink, and there would be winter, and it would be 17 below zero, and there'd be these 2 old women that go to Urban Renewal, and they just talk all the time, and they really made my hair hurt, and I would see them, and so I would change that header sign that says garage out of service. And then I would just pull over, and they would say, what's wrong, Virginia? And I'd say, well, I have to go into the garage. Your bus will be along any minute. And there wouldn't be another bus for 45 minutes. And I didn't care. I just left them in the snow, and I would go pull my bus over, put my feet up on the dash, turn up Olivia Newton-John, and just drink. And I didn't care, and I continued to drink, because I hated the person that I'd become, and I couldn't stop drinking. And somewhere on April Fool's Day in 1974, I must have gone out to McDonald's for something to eat, because on the way back, I hit 12 parked cars, utility pole, put the power out on the north side of Bloomington for about, you know, 12 hours, and I hit, I took the corner off a house. And I backed up and I took off to go home, and the fire chief was inside, he was having coffee with his mother, and he was not at all pleased. And so by the time I'm parking my car with the smoke coming out of the front of my house, you know, here come the police, here comes the sirens, you know, I got out of my car, I did what any good alcoholic would do, I ran to the front door. And they arrested me, they arrested my lover, Steph, for interfering in my arrest. I had a blood alcohol count of 0.33, so they put me in the drunk tank, and I got out, and I got a bicycle. That car didn't work anymore, so I got a bike, and I had a bicycle with a wicker basket. And I would drive that bicycle down to the first liquor store that opened in the morning in Bloomington, Indiana. It was called Brent, and it would open at 6 o'clock. And it's amazing, you know, drunk, totally wasted. I knew what liquor store opened when. This is like, you know, you go to a meeting now, and all the homeless people, they know exactly when the AA meeting, what time it starts, what food's there. I knew what liquor store was open. And I rode my bicycle down there, and I got myself a bottle of vodka, and I would pass it around to all the wino friends of mine, and we'd throw hit two belts back, I'd throw up, and then I would chew that cap, and I would go home, you know, and I would sit in my apartment, and I was just always trying to figure it out. I was seeing shrinks, you know, asking them, why do I drink so much, you know? Somebody help me, you know, why do I drink so much? And people would say, well, you know, Virginia, you be you, and then you have a conversation with your mother. Your mother here, and I'm like, oh, it'd be so loaded going to these sessions. Nothing happened, you know, and of course I continued to drink, and I continued to lie about it, and I continued to hide booze, and by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had 14 car wrecks, you know, and I'd broken all the bones in the right side of my face, and you know, just this and that, and driven, you know, I forced a farmer off the road one year. I just got here, and what happened was, I was a regular patient at Bloomington south, which is like the psych ward. And I would go there all the time trying to ask these doctors why I drank so much. I knew there was something wrong. And what happened to me was Sarah talked me, my lover talked me into going into the hospital. And I walked into the hospital with a blood alcohol count of 0.489. And pretty much 50% of my blood was bruised, you know, and I walked in with that same attitude, you know, keep your hands off me, you know, you're all losers, you know, they'll never take me alive. And, you know, I just walked in there with my profound arrogance, you know, and on the fourth day I had a abdominal seizure. And I flopped around the floor like a chicken. They took, you know, the tongue depress up DT for 7 days and seven nights. And people came to see me, and you know, but Sarah came and she said, you know, you were awful. They wish they had filmed it. You spit in people's faces. You pulled the IVs out with your teeth. And I said, Sarah, all I remember from that experience was that there was a rock band practicing in the hospital. And I kept saying I was going to see them when I got out of there because they were interfering with my sleep. And she said, you were awful. Awful. I said, well, I remember, I felt like I was, you know, locked up in some mental institution, you know, where they rolled me out every day, you know, tied in a wheelchair, and people said, good morning, Ms. Peacock, and I couldn't talk because I'd lost the ability to talk, you know. I was like a wet brain. And, you know, I got out of that hospital, and did I quit drinking? No. I went right out, and I bought a quart of vodka, and I drank it just like it was water. And I got all nervous, and Sarah got all nervous and called the doctors, and the doctor said, just keep her moving, don't let her sleep. You know, just keep her moving for the weekend so she won't have another seizure. So Sarah took me down to Josette and Les Farm down in Paoli, Indiana, and there was like 100 degrees, 115 humidity, they were curing cottage cheese that was dripping over here, and I was just like, the sweat was just pouring off of me because it was totally detoxing. And I remember she kept walking me up and down these bean fields, and I just cried out, you know, God help me, somebody help me, I can't quit drinking. And I just cried the whole weekend. And come Monday, I still worked for the city. However, they didn't want me driving a bus anymore, but they had me working on the street department, painting curbs yellow for $2.50, and that was my job. And that day my pantry took a break in a diner where we go for biscuits and gravy. And inside that diner was this woman whose name was Gulf of Virginia. She was a hairdresser in Bloomington, and she said, come here, sit down, how are you? I heard you were in the hospital. And it was just the same God that I screamed out to and asked for help over the weekend showed up, you know, and I just blurted out, you know, Virginia, I'm drinking again. And I'm really scared. And she said, well, you know, she told me so sure about the widow Hahn, this florist that we knew, and his boyfriend had gone off to chit-chat in Pennsylvania, and he got out and started drinking again. She said, well, you know, Jenny, there's two women in town. They met at Hazelden Treatment Center. They fell in love with each other. They divorced their husbands. They live here in town, and they started a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Will you talk to them? And I said, yes. So that night, when I got home from work, the phone was ringing. I picked up and said hello, and the woman said, hi, my name's Dee. We've heard about you. Can we come over? And I said, yes. And so Dee and Paula came to my house that night. It was a Monday night, and they said, we're from Alcoholics Anonymous, and we know how you feel. And I consider those the five most important words anyone ever told me. You know, we know how you feel. They hadn't had a drink one day at a time for over 2 years. And they said, you know, there's meeting on Sunday night, and we'll come get you. And I said, no, you won't. And I'll get there on my own. I don't know if I drank from Monday to Sunday. I mean, I honestly don't know. It's just a total fault for me. But on that Sunday, it was July 13th, 1974, when I woke up, I said to Sarah, I'm not going to drink today. I'm going to that meeting tonight. And I went to that meeting that night, and I never took another drink. So the way to get, you know, from there to here is you don't drink. I didn't go to treatment. I didn't take anything. I didn't do anything. I just stopped drinking. And when I got here, I stuttered. I mean, I lost some sort of ability to talk, and so I was just I stuttered all the time. I weighed 185 pounds. My teeth were rotten. They used to pay me to use my mouth for oral exams for dental people. And I had a pair of jeans to my name, and I owed thousands of dollars to people that I had ripped off, including Indiana University. So I had a bicycle to my name and a pair of jeans, and that was it. And Bea and Paula said, "We're going to be your sponsors." I never knew that to choose. They said, "You're going to be the coffee maker at the Sunday night meeting, because people who do service stay sober." And that's the thing I particularly like about this conference this weekend, you know. It's all about service. I mean, it's all about service. I was recently in Dallas speaking down there, and Dr. Michael and I had two newcomers in the back of the car. We just, I mean, in and out, in and out. And Dr. Michael said to them, "Do you want to know the secret word? Do you want to really know the word to staying sober?" And they're like, "Yeah, yeah. What is it? What is it?" You know, and he said, "Server." I mean, and it's just it. You know, people who do service stay sober. And I've been doing it for the last 26 years. You know, I'll be 27 years sober in July 13th, you know, in just a few weeks. And it's amazing to me, because I didn't come here and say, "Phew, I'm so glad I found you people. I've really been suffering. You know, I've learned this beautiful program. I want to clean up my life." Nothing. I mean, I did not want to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. The people that were in the room were old people, and they had blue rinses, and they were old people. I mean, I missed my peer group, and but I came, you know, and they talked about God, and I said my first year sobriety was, "I ain't gonna buy this God crap." And one of the women said, "Well, honey, you can borrow my God until you get your own." And another one said, "You can't have mine. He's busy with me." And so, you know, they would just say all these dumb things. And I couldn't laugh. You know, I had lost the ability to laugh. Nothing was funny. I was really tragedian. I mean, it was really a tragic. I would go home after meetings and sit in front of the mirror and try to laugh. And like, oh, seriously. I just couldn't laugh. It had been so long since I laughed. And I kept showing up every week, and I would try to get out of my commitment. One meeting a week. I mean, and I would call Tim Paul and say, "You know, this really great Bob Donovich film, you know, the last picture show's on tonight, and so I don't think I'll be coming." And, you know, Paul would say something like, "Yeah, that's a really great movie, but our sobriety is more important," and they would hang up. So, you know, I would go to the meeting, you know, just to, and so I always went, and I never said my name's Jimmy. I'm an alcoholic for a year. And, you know, in Indiana, they do the same thing they do in Texas, where they say, you know, "My name's Jimmy, I'm an alcoholic, sober today through the grace of God and fellowship, alcoholics, and I'm the way of life, and people tell me how to live. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since July 13th, 1975. Then I came here and listened to all this, and I'm like, "Oh, man, I mean, I can't do that. I wouldn't even say that I was an alcoholic until I was a year sober." And when I was a year sober, I spoke, and they gave me a cake, and the cake had a dump truck and a stop sign on it, you know, and one candle. And I still rode that bike. I rode that bike 7 miles to work, you know, and back. And then finally, you know, I was assigned just for a year, and then my mother bought me a car. And my sponsor said, "You're going to pay your mother back. Every month, on the first of every month, you don't slide on payments to your mother. You're going to pay her for that car." I had to pay my mother for this car. It was a Javelin. It only went forward. It had no reverse. And I would drive it, you know, all the way up to Indianapolis to a meeting, which was 60 miles one way, because I was, you know, looking for my peer group. And I was up for Monday, Tuesday, Friday. I mean, I went up to Indianapolis all the time. I was listening to this great step meeting today, and they were talking about the fourth step, you know, and I did a fourth step, kind of with Ian Paul, and I filled out some Hazelden guide, but I left out a lot, you know. I thought I was too dirty for Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you really knew what I'd really done, I wouldn't get to stay here. And I met this woman in Indianapolis named Iris. And Iris and her husband, Bob, had come from the Huntington Group in Long Island, and they lived in Indianapolis, and were sober quite a while. And I knew, I never heard Iris talk about anyone or anything, and I thought, I'm going to She's the woman that's going to hear my fourth step. And they said it time and time again, you know, if you skip this vital step, you may not overcome drinking. So I realized if I didn't do a fourth and fifth step, I would probably get drunk. And I did a fourth step when I was 2.5 years sober. I did, you know, legal pad, all the seven deadly sins, and I went back to teaching school. And I got a job teaching in inner city Indianapolis, an all-black school. It was fabulous. And then the next year I went to a gifted class. And that year I had a girlfriend in Indianapolis, and we saw that in the back of the grapevine, there was, they lived all the conferences, and one of them was a gay conference in San Francisco. So I said to Jill Judy, let's go. So we went away to San Francisco to this conference, and I came back and I had this Living Sober t-shirt on, 1978, and there was this guy, you know, in the room, you know, with a big beer gut, and he said, well, I was out there. I said, well, when were you there? He said, well, I was there last week. And I said, well, I was there last week too. And he said, well, I didn't see you at any meetings I went to. And I said, no, I guess we didn't go to the same meetings. And then he turned to the guy next to him and he said, you know, told there was one of those parades, you know, with all these queers marching down the street, and 250,000 people showed up to look at all those queers. And I just sort of recoiled and just from a high plane, and I moved back across the room, and I turned to this woman, Lee, and I said, you know, I hate that SOB, blah, 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 blah. And I was all red, you know, but I wouldn't say anything. She said, well, Virginia, maybe it's time you have to do something about that. And so, I mean, I started the first gay meeting in my house in Bloomington, Indiana, and so many kids showed up, you know, the house literally sank, and the foundation sank, and, you know, the dykes had to take off that front screen door so people could leave, and they got out those tools, and then so we finally, you know, we went to churches, and the churches wouldn't take us, they thought it was great, we wanted to do something about our drinking, but what about that other problem? We said, well, we don't see it as a problem. And he said, well, we do, and you're not welcome here. So, you know, the women's bookstore took us, and on it went. And 1979, I was invited to come out and speak at Living Sober, and I did, and, you know, I've been in the Bay Area ever since. And I don't go to gay meetings anymore. I mean, I stay in the center of the lifeboat. You know, my story is my story. It doesn't change, you know. I'm just very comfortable with who I am today as a result of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I finally told my little Friday night staff meeting, you know, nobody had come out for a speak in Indianapolis, and I said, well, I want you to know I'm queer, I'm a lesbian, I'm gay, I used every bad word, and they all came up to me after me and said, well, we knew anyway. But we don't care. I mean, nobody really cares. It was just all in my head. And you know, I came to San Francisco, and I wrote back to my students and told them why I had left. I said, I left because I'm tired of living a lie, and I'm gay, and, you know, the kids wrote back, you're Mrs. Peacock, we knew anyway. So it was sort of, you know, they all knew, even my mother, when I got on to tell her. And today, it's not, you know, I'm not an alcoholic because I happen to be, you know, gay. I'm not an alcoholic because my husband beat me. I'm not an alcoholic because my father was, you know, abusive. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. Maybe, you know, I had a genetic predisposition. I don't know. And it doesn't matter why I drank. You know, all those years I went to all those doctors saying, why? I mean, somebody help me. Why do I drink so much? Only when Dee and Paula came to my house that night and I said, why? Why do I drink so much? And they said, we don't care why you drink so much, but we can tell you how to stay sober. And that's all you need to know. You need, it's honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. You know, and you take the body to the meetings, you know, and the rest will follow. And doing service. And, you know, so my life has been pretty fantastic in my journey of sobriety. I became a realtor in San Francisco like in 1981, so I've been a realtor. I've had the same profession for 20 years. And I love it. I mean, and the one thing that's remained constant in my life, I mean, lovers have come and gone. I still haven't done really well in that department. When I got sober, being Paul said to me, you know, Jimmy, I mean, I was dragging home everything, you know, guys and men, women from the softball team. And being Paul said, you know, Jimmy, we don't think that relationships are your forte. So why don't you see if you can find somebody to help and take them to the meeting this weekend? You know, when I was living in Indianapolis, they used to call up Iris all the time, you know, and I mean mine and wine. It was like the wine 1-1 call. And she used to say, you know, Jimmy, your self-absorption is driving me crazy. She said, don't call me back until you found someone to work with. And she hung up. And I went and found someone to work with, and I started taking them to meetings, and that's the way it's been. And I've had sponsors my entire sobriety. My sponsor today is Clancy I in Los Angeles, and he's been very helpful to me. He's been my sponsor for like the last 7 or 8 years, and I broke my neck in 1997. In a car accident down on Devil's Slide going home, you know, where I live in Montana. And they drilled one of those, you know, halos into my skull. And, you know, by the time I got to the hospital that night, before they drilled the halo in, you know, my little son, Pete Hannah, was there. And, you know, they came and, you know, I broke C3 and C6 top and bottom. And he drove that halo in, and I had to wear it for 2.5 months. I sold real estate the whole time. I mean, it was like my best year ever. except for the last 2 years. I mean, the last 2 years were like a boom town. But, I had a girlfriend in Oakland, and I would ride into town because I couldn't drive because I couldn't hear my head. And I would go down to Texas Avenue with her, and then I would go down to BART, and I would take BART out to the Balboa Park Station. I would take a bus through Ingleside over to Stonestown. I'd walk a mile and a half to my office, and I would work. I mean, I was willing to go to any length to get to work. I'm my only contributor, you know. I'm self-supporting through only my own contributions, so if I don't work, I don't eat. And, you know, I was willing to go to any length to stay sober, and I'm still willing to go to any length to stay sober. I was always told I can't say no. I mean, I don't like to speak. I mean, I have to tell you, I don't send tapes out. I don't audition. I don't, you know, I don't want to go to, you know, this place or that place to speak. I mean, I always say yes when I'm asked because I was told that we don't say no in alcoholic anonymous except for the drink. And when I say I never want to drink again, I never want to drink again, and I will do whatever it takes to stay sober. And this girlfriend I've been with for like the last 6 years, she has two daughters. They are 15 and 17 now, teenage kids, and they're nice kids, and they don't drink or do drugs, and they're sort of a rarity in their school. But about 3 or 4 years ago, I was just ratting out all over the place. I mean, I wanted to come first, and the kids came first, and I couldn't stand the kids coming first because I'm a self-centered, self-seeking, self-absorbed alcoholic, and I wanted to pay more attention to me. And so I would be complaining about it to Clancy. You know, Clancy would say, you know, Jimmy, those kids all they have is their mother, and if you cannot let those kids come first and let those kids have their mother, then you need to get out of the relationship. And, you know, my girlfriend was not in the program. She was drinking and lying about it because, you know, I said, you know, if you're going to be with me, you're not going to drink. And so for all kinds of reasons, I got out of the relationship. I just took a year off, and I got back with her a year ago, and the first thing that came to my mind was, I know I have to make amends to those girls. And I went to see each one of them separately and said I was wrong. And I regret my behavior. I was just so selfish and self-seeking, and I could not, I was just jealous, and I'm sorry I brought it out. And Emily said, well, you know, you made my mom cry a lot. And I don't think we ever know how much harm we do, you know, when we're acting out all the time. And, you know, we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, it's like you bring the drunken horse thief here and you sober up. You have to, what do you have? A sober horse thief. And, you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous completely selfish, self-centered, rotten, brat, alcoholic, you know, and it sobered me up, and I was the same. But as a result of doing the steps, you know, I've gotten better. And I don't act as badly as I used to do. Although I'm not perfect by a long shot. And, you know, there's some great things that have happened to me in sobriety. My mother was 25 pages of my four steps. I hated her. I mean, it was, you know, I resent my mother. She did, she that, she never told me she loved me. She, you know, I didn't like her. She always sent me money. She never asked to talk about anything but the weather, and just on and on and on. You know, and she said she's the best mother, but I didn't like my mother. And I did the fourth step with Iris. And when I got done with the fourth step, Iris said to me, you know, Jenny, you got the mother that you got. And she loves you the only way she knows how. It's just not the way you want. And my mother went on my eight-step list, and then for the next 20-some years, you know, I made amends to her. I made living amends. She lives in Florida. I would go to Florida to see her once a year, and then it became like four times a year. And I wore clothes that she would like. You know, I left the jeans with the ass out and the knees out. I left them at home. And I quit saying the F word every four words. And I was nice to her friends, and I acted right when I went there, and I sat with her, and she got progressively sick over the years, and I was sitting with my mother, you know, and the last year that she was alive, and I was sitting with her watching television, and she would suck her teeth, you know, for like 4 hours, and I thought, oh, I'm gonna, and I was just, I said, Mother, I'll be right back in a minute. And I would go into my bedroom, and I would get out a pen and paper, and I would write a 10-step, I would write God. I was there, my mother. She continues to suck her teeth all the time. You know, she's making me mental. I mean, I can't stand it. She did. And then I got to the fear underneath, because anger only masks fear, and under all my anger was my self-centered fear. I have fear I'm going to act out again. Fear I'm going to slam the door. Fear I'm going to tell her off. Fear she'll die. And then I woke up nothing but a brat again, because that was my M.O. I used to just brat out, slam the door, I'm gone, and they wouldn't find me for 6 months. And, you know, and when I was around, even in sobriety, people were like walking on eggshells because I was such a lunatic. And so I would go in and I would write this all down, and then I would write, I'm now entirely ready for you, God, to remove these resentments and fears, clean to remove them. I pray only for the knowledge of your will for me and the power to carry out. Thank you. Amen. Jenny. So it was like all the steps, you know, three, that, four. And I would come back and I'd sit down next to my mother and she'd say, well, what's wrong? I'd say, oh, nothing. I just thought of something I had to do for work. And I would sit then with her because I had gone to the solution, given it up to God, and sat and was able to be with my mother. And my mother did die in 95, and she got really sick in the month of May, and I flew to Florida because, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, when we do what's the right thing to do, and I was always said, right feeling, follow right action, and I was there for a month, and my mother had four surgeries, they amputated her leg, and she was still dying with a great deal of dignity, and, you know, I was acting out all over the place, but I showed up every day for her at the hospital, and before my mother died, she said, you know, Jenny, you've been a good daughter. And she said, will you please try to have a relationship with your brother? I call my brother down from Grand Rapids, Michigan. I mean, he's a Republican, and his wife spells Mary Kay. And so here comes my brother, you know, in his plaid shorts and saying that. And I never spoke to my brother my whole life. Whenever it was Christmas, I would ask my mother, well, what does Bill want? You know, I would never call my brother and ask him. I mean, I hated him. I mean, when I was a kid and I had to pour his milk, I spit in it. So here I am. I'm calling my brother down to Florida. My mom is dying and I have to be with him every day for like 30 days. And I had to talk and I had to be like a sister. Like, what do you want to do for dinner? And, you know, and we started to talk, and so the healing began, you know, we began to be like a brother and a sister. And, you know, my mother was on a ventilator, and ultimately we had to unplug her, and she did die. And my brother called me and said, well, we're going to have a service, you know, on July 13th in Kendall, Indiana. And I said, oh my God, do you know what day that is? And he said, yeah, it's a Thursday. And I said, no, that's the day I got sober, like 21 years ago. And so I went back, you know, and I spoke about my mom, you know, at the service, and I was like, so good to be back, and I went to a class reunion. And, you know, I did the right thing. And, you know, recently this old guy named Irwin Karp, who was secretary of central office in San Francisco for a while, I used to call him Dad, you know. He would always go to the home group on Tuesday night, Saturday night at 22nd Grill. And Erwin and I split up to Vacaville together for 10 years once a month, and we never missed. And, I mean, so when I came to San Francisco in 1979, I rushed right out to get an H&I commitment. And telling everyone, you know, well, I used to go to the women's prison in Indianapolis, and he wouldn't give me a commitment for 2 years. He said I was really sick. And I guess I was. But finally they gave me a commitment at the psych ward, you know, and I love that commitment. And, you know, you're sitting in there telling your story with some guy, and they come here every month, and you're writing a juicy part of your story, and the whole room just gets up and walks out. And, you know, they come back in and they interrupt you, and, hey, you got a cigarette? And, you know, he's asking you to smoke. And then ultimately I got the job at Vacaville, and I went up there with her once for 10 years, and we became really good friends. And I called my dad, and he got sick recently with lung cancer. He was a big smoker, just in case you're all wondering what you're going to do when this meeting's over. You know, he got sick, and he was in this convalescent center in San Francisco, and I started going to this Sunday Big Book meeting because I was dressed up, because it was Sunday and I'm a realtor, and I looked nice, and so I would go to this Big Book meeting, and I would go around the corner and see everyone every Sunday. And, you know, I'm sure I made his day, because I would just walk in, and, you know, they're all lined up, you know, with their chairs, their bibs on, and, you know, Dad! And I took him a bunch of gifts on Father's Day, and, you know, he said, you know, would you go to more specific and get me a corned beef? And I said, sure. And why? I said, Steve, he was, yeah. But I never met him because he died on Tuesday. And, you know, I just, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did the right thing and I went to see him every Sunday. And I love that. And, you know, I just saw my tailor the other day, and he had told me about 6 months ago that Barbara, you know, the love of my life, the first love of my life, was dying of cancer, the esophagus. And either she wanted me to call or somebody wanted me to call, and I should call her. So I called Bernie Indiana, and she was there, and I said, hi, Barbara, it's me, Peacock. And she said, oh, how are you? And I said, well, I'm fine. And, you know, when Barbara, after I had broken up with her years ago, she moved to Chicago. She worked for EarthCupNet. She wrote a book, and I was part of the book. And she'd come to Chicago and put a bottle of booze in front of me and turn on a tape recorder. And everything I said came out in the book. And I hated her for that, and I never did forgive her. And so I called her, and she said, so what's up? And I said, well, my first thought was, I wonder if I owe you any amends. And she said, no, you laughed. And she said, no, you don't owe me any, but I bet I owe you some. And I said, well, I'm sure you do. However, I said, it doesn't matter what they, she said, well, I don't remember what they are. And I said, me neither. And it doesn't matter what they are, because I forgive you for any of it. And she said, thank you for that. And we talked about Junior, and Junior was dying, couldn't stay sober. And, you know, she said, did you call to say goodbye? And I said, no, I didn't say goodbye today, but I'll call you next week. And I decided I would call her on Monday, but Monday came. I thought, no, I got very dramatic. I said, I'll call her on Tuesday. It'll be like Tuesdays with Maureen. And I'll call her every Tuesday. And I called her on Tuesday, and there was no answer. And I left a message, and that night I got a call back that said Barbara died yesterday. And all I could think of was what Marie Skinner had told me, and Marie died this last week too in Southern California, and Alban Carruthers had been his sponsor. And Marie said, Ginny, you got to pray to be big enough, to be small enough, to be used. And I was just grateful that when I got the call that said, you know, will you call Barbara, I just, you know, I was big enough to be small enough to use, and I gave her the opportunity to forgive her, and it was all clean, and, you know, boom. Everything I've learned, you know, I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, totally. I didn't know how to act right. I didn't know how to be a daughter. I didn't know how to be a friend. I didn't know how to be a good worker. I didn't know how to be responsible. I didn't know how to keep a commitment. You know, Clancy says, you know, we keep our commitments unless there's a death in the family, and it better be yours. And, I mean, I keep my commitments, and if I say I'm going to be somewhere, I'm usually early. And, you know, I have a God in my life. I pray to this God. You know, when he first got sober, I'd just say, you know, to him and make him turn. You know, I need help. I would never say the word God for a long time. And Today, you know, I get on my knees in the morning and I say, good morning, God, it's me, Jimmy, I'm an alcoholic, I need help today. Whatever your will is for me today, just give me the power and strength to carry it out. Thy will, not mine, be done. Thank you for my sobriety, and that's it. Anyway, I got on my knees before I came down here to speak, and I said, God, you know, help me carry the message. I hope I can help one person in the room today. You know, I have to say, you know, the only thing I can say, which is, my name is Jimmy Peacock. I'm an alcoholic. The sober today through the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way of life and people have taught me, I have not necessarily taken a drink since July 13th, 1974, for that I'm eternally grateful. Thank you for my life.